I thought I'd start by just asking you a little bit specifically about this program and ask you to talk a little bit about what goes into developing a solo program for you. So how do you approach it?
I try to have a variety of pieces. As you saw, there are pieces that are Thelonious Monk pieces most people know already, that can be abstracted, that have a very definite structure to them, and then mix them in with some things that are freer and are original. So I basically had like half original material. Only one of those had a form that was based on chords and that I stuck to, and everything else was free. So at the same time, I don't want to do like an encyclopedia of piano styles, and so I like to keep the focus, you know, in one area and make the styles from which it comes from peripheral. So you can have Warren Marsh and All of Me, you know, chord changes, but it wouldn't sound out of place with a really free stuff.
And just thinking, like I have a sense that when someone puts a solo program together, there's one of two general tacks that the preparation for that might take. One would be that the day before they choose the tunes that they're going to play. And the other might be that someone spends a very long, out of a general repertoire that they might have prepared. And another might be real intense work on a specific repertoire. Which of those?
So Ken called me and asked me to do this a month and a half ago. And then I spent the first week compiling a list of 30 pieces that I wanted to do, and then narrowing it down, and then I really spent a lot of time developing this program, the order of things and taking things out, and certain things morphed from one thing into another, and so I was a little obsessive about it and practiced it ad infinitum. I think the hardest thing playing solo is not knowing the piece and the material, but just the controlling the psychology, you know, in performance. just to be able to discover things and surprise yourself and bounce off of the discovery of something new while performing. It's much easier to do when no one's listening. It's higher stakes when you have an audience. So that's always the challenge with solo.
I wanted to ask some questions about things that you alluded to right out of the gate, having to do with structure and having to do with questions of how harmony functions in your music, particularly if we're thinking in general terms, the idea of playing piano in what is often referred to as post-chord changes music almost immediately brings up the conundrum of like what happens to the chords, or in what sense does harmony exist within that music. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your approach to that solution.
There's no one approach. There are many different approaches. So there are times even within the same piece when I will be taking a more harmonic approach and use scales or use wrong scales on purpose. So for example, if I set up one tonality, or if I'm playing like a Monk tune and the chord is X, you know, and the correct choices are A, B, C, I might go for Z, you know, on purpose, just to and then resolve with a more correct one. So that would be a very deliberate harmonic choice. Other times I don't think at all about that, and I just make the melody and I just follow my ear and my instinct to develop a melody, and I just avoid anything that would sound tonal. So over time everybody develops techniques, you know, to play melodies and avoid tonality. So you kind of control, you know, to what degree you want to sound tonal and to what degree you want to sound atonal. So, I mean, you know, listening to second Viennese school composers and so forth finds its place. In, but when you listen to people like Cecil Taylor, it's not atonal. Everybody has their devices, you know, and there are moments that are more explained, that can be explained with an organization of pitches and so forth, and there are moments that can be totally free and gestural and based on thematic development, ideas, gestures, textures, things like that. So you, at those points, you avoid tonality. I don't know if I'm really answering.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what it makes me think about is that there's another school that I think is very different from the way that you approach kind of how to test those limits or how to push at the limits of the place where melodic material and harmonic material converge. And that's like typified by someone like Brad Meldow, who is utmost concern has to do with form, like keeping the form, except pushing the form to a place where it's right. Almost unrecognizable as form. And the thing is that it plays very much into a kind of attitude about jazz that has to do with like that there's some secret agenda that the real scientists know about, yeah. And they're sitting in the back figuring out, oh, he's made a substitution, but it's still the right chord.
Right.
And what is interesting to me is that kind of when you let the air out of that balloon and yeah. Suddenly it's not this test all the time right. About whether the form has been held. It opens all sorts of new things up. And it was really delightful, is always delightful yeah. Listening to you play, because I feel like I'm not concerned with that when I hear a fragment of a melody that I recognize, I understand that it implies a lot.
Right. And that is something that it took me a while to get used to that, because I also came up through a very standard-based education, you know, keep the form, whatever you do has to always resolve, four beats to a bar. And then playing, like Nate McBride, for example, was a great person to play with, because we could veer off and then meet again. And he and like other bass players that I knew before who were always, oh, you dropped a beat, you know, or something. But he was very supportive of that, and we developed that, you know. And he saw, like, when I played Locomotive, for example, sometimes I'll just play the form and do, you know, weird things and stay with the form, but sometimes I just like to go off and do something, an extra, you know, 30 seconds that don't belong in the form, and then come back to it, or just play something that is related to the feel of the tune or the basic theme. So yeah, there's no jazz police here.
With that in mind, I'm curious about how reiteration or how playing ahead twice in a tune functions for you now. Because in a way, it's possible to play, and you, I think, exemplified this a couple of times tonight, it's possible to play a piece as a through composition, so not necessarily playing the composed material a second time.
Correct.
But when you do that now, when the form isn't the thing that's dictating everything, what does it mean to you to go back to that material again? How does it function for you?
It functions as a signpost, you know, like an obvious, you know, bookend. I mean, that's a traditional thing, but I sometimes I like to start from nowhere and end with that, or not end with it. I'm slowly becoming more open to that idea. Maybe most of the tunes I played tonight ended with the way they started. But I am finding that as time goes on, I never felt that before, but I kind of find now that there's an absurdity to the jazz form, but this is the head, this is the form, and you repeat it, and you repeat it, and you repeat it, and then you play the head out again. That is something I never thought I would feel tired of, now that... I don't know, maybe later on I will stop coming back to the heads or have a different head. Sometimes though, when I write things, sometimes I finish off with a different with different written material, not with the one that I started with. So that's something I'm developing, and it's great that you pointed out it is kind of a relic of, or maybe, you know, something I haven't gotten rid of yet.
But I hear you monkeying with it, you know, like I hear it really kind of being tested in certain ways, or sort of played with in really interesting ways. Like, yeah. I mean, at times it was hard to recognize a theme, but I could tell that that was there, and I knew you were dismantling it in certain ways. Yeah. And so it didn't have the kind of mnemonic function of saying, okay, we said it at the beginning, and now I'm going to remind you at the end that I said it at the beginning, and then in some way, in a conventional setting, everything in between it has to somehow relate to it. And then there's the whole trip aspect of, like, journey aspect of it, where you start here and then you end up back home again or something.
I mean, the
like
reason
that
these things exist are because, you all know, it's because it's a springboard to get you going, and it's a signal that it has ended. So they play a very practical role in improvisation.
Yeah. I remember the first time I heard musicians totally invert that, I think was on a record, the title of which I don't remember, but it was Butch Morris, Wayne Horvitz, and William Parker, a record on Soul Note. I can't remember the title exactly. But it started, I thought it was going to be a totally freely improvised music record. And it's two sides, same piece, two sides. And about... at the end of the first side, after having played completely open music, they play a theme. Mm-hmm. And then they go away from the theme. So they just invert the idea. They never come back to it, because it starts, in fact, the head in this case is the freely improvised part, which I think is such an interesting thing. And I was really preparing for tonight, listening to a lot of your music. Yes. I was thinking about, like, I mean, Monk used the head is such an important thing, and Monk is such a keystone for you. I was thinking of asking you a little bit.
He never stops playing the head, really. I mean, well, in a sense. But then, like, I played Panonica, I did just one chorus, so, I mean, where am I going to play the head, you know? But this idea of different ways of presenting the material, like, are you going to play the beginning and the end, or just at some point, or are you going to go through, like, some written material, then improvise, then some other written material? I mean, these are things that concern, especially, there are a lot of Chicago musicians that write that way and use that. So it's something that's really alive and is developing even now by different musicians. It's a great area to dabble in.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like to live and work in Boston these days. We have Boston in common. And so I'm kind of curious. In some ways, it feels a little bit, from a distance, it feels a little bit like Chicago in the sense that I know Chicago's got a more, somewhat more developed infrastructure. But what I was kind of curious about was the, I mean, there's a second city syndrome that we have. And Boston, when I was there, always felt a little bit like it had that at a closer, you know, proximity to
New York. I don't think Chicago has a second city to New York, at least in the improvised music scene. I think it's a first city. But Boston lacks in many other places. First of all, we don't have venues. So, I mean, here you have, I don't know if it has to do with real estate, liquor license. I think all that plays a role. But we just don't have venues that would support music that is not like really straight ahead. And then also the community is much more fragmented. Here you see that there is, when you go to hear one person play here, a band, you see all these musicians come and hang out, and there's a really strong sense of support of the community. And then different musicians, each one is hosting or curating a series here or there. It's a very active scene. That is totally the opposite in Boston.
I guess what I'm interested in about it is that these things feel cyclical to me. And yeah. I remember when you moved to Boston in 1985.
Right.
Which is around the time that I was really hanging out there. And my feeling at that time was that there was a really amazing scene there.
Right.
And partially because it really at that point took a couple of people organizing stuff and really busting ass.
Joe Morris was one of them.
And absolutely.
Maybe you were one of them and a few others. But it's true. There were all these clubs, the 1369, Charlie's Tap, Night Stage, that had improvised music, and they would bring people every week. And that just went away. And now we just have two hotels that bring, very straight ahead big acts, and we just have like a couple of small places where you basically have to pay, they take a guarantee, so it's very difficult to get an audience, and so it is cyclical.
Yeah.
And we're on the low side of that cycle,
and we used to be there. Yeah. And I think we're in a good place now. But I remember a time here where it felt very much like that. You've said all the same things that we all felt: fragmented, no venues.
But you see that everywhere in the cities, wherever you go, you see that it's always like when you have a scene, there are like four or five people that are crazy enough to be active in this kind of stuff, devoting their time and their energy and their money and whatever to support these things. And then you see when one or two of them go, the scene collapses. So I think this music is fragile and depends on people's support.
On real human beings.
Yeah.
And not only on institutions.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's true. Can open up to people's questions. I don't know, that seems like a place to transition to.
I have a question about kind of the hand and the ear.
Yeah.
So John was talking about kind of tonality and atonality and form and formlessness. And when you play the piano within a form, it's very easy to kind of play a scale that you know will sound right even if you're not hearing it, right? They call it crypts, you know?
Correct.
Levels, right?
Yeah.
Within an atonal thing, you can, of course, play a gesture.
Yeah.
Since nothing doesn't fit, it's a lot even easier.
Yeah.
How do you stay present so that you're actually hearing what you're playing and not just moving your muscles?
Well, it's that's very interesting. What you would call intuitive or even random is never random when you have spent enough time on your instrument. So the proof for that is if you put someone who's never played the piano in front of a piano and you ask them to play, it won't sound controlled. Mm-hmm. It won't sound as intentional. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's such a thing as random for someone who's played enough and knows their instrument enough. I think there's an intuition which is an internalized knowledge, and you think you're doing something random, but it's not. And so that's basically my answer, that it's controlled because you know enough how to avoid. I mean, you will never hear an octave or a major triad when I do that kind of stuff.
Why not?
Because I'm controlling that. I know how to stay away from that. If I'm making that texture, I want it to sound a certain way, and I've done it enough that I know how to avoid it. I mean, that's true for anyone who plays that way. Whereas someone who doesn't know, you know, basic, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing it makes me think of is you played a Misha Mengelberg tune, and I think Misha is the elephant in the room as far as that goes, which is, I mean, Misha, I don't know if you know his music, but Misha Mengelberg's one of the great improvisers of all time, and also a fantastic composer, Dutch piano player. And Misha spent a fair amount of time observing his cat playing, like walking around on the piano, because he said, the thing is that cat, without intending to make music, makes much more compelling music than I can when I try to be random. Yeah.
That's because he was he's a Dadaist and so forth. But I really think that intuition is internalized knowledge. And I think that's what it comes down to.
but the reason I brought that up is to say, I think the point is context. So all of these things are, it's not a question of being anything goes, and it's not a question of it's not allowed. It's a question of what is the consequence of doing one thing or doing another thing. So so it's all about context. Within a certain context, there are consequences one way or another. So if you're playing a tune that's got very clear structure, clear chordal cycle, and you play outside of it, it has one consequence, right? So it's not that it's a law that you can't do it. Means that there's a consequence of doing that. And if you choose to try to do something that introduces an element of the uncontrolled into a context in which control is there, that also has a consequence. It's not allowed. It's not better or worse. And that's what I learned from watching Misha. One night at the BIM house, Misha actually was starting concert, Han Bennink was playing, and somebody else was playing with him, and Misha hadn't started yet. He had a cup of coffee in one hand and a cigarette in the other, and some sort of a croissant in the other hand. So it was impossible for him to play the piano. So with his dangling cigarette, he said to Steve Beresford, who was sitting in the front, "Steve, would you get this started for me?" And Steve said, "What do you want me to do? Just take the piano stool and turn it upside down on the keyboard, which dutifully Steve Beresford did. It sounded like you would think it would sound. It was just basically a big, ugly cluster, but it did something. It had a consequence. And so that's my response is right. a little bit that, because sometimes introducing something that even isn't control or intuition can have a positive.
I want to add that also what you don't play is very important. The gestures you don't make, the effect, you know, the grandiosity or the melancholy or the dramatic or the whatever you don't do in your music is just as important as what you do in your music. So a big part of it is what you have chosen not to do.
I don't know. Absolutely.
That for me is very important. When I listen to other people play, it's like the certain gestures just seem so empty and superfluous. So the control, yes, there is how well do you control the tonality, but how well do you stay consistent with some higher level decisions. When I say higher level, I mean, you know, there are like, what do you want your music to sound like? What are your references? What kind of sound do you find inspirational, and what do you think is trite? What do you think is non-essential, so forth? And then you can come down to like picking the pitches and the rest of it, the rhythms.
So how does one know what you don't play? Because somehow it's like a ghost, right? It's something which is like a spirit which is not coming into the place.
Yeah, I think
so. It's like a negative aspect of the music.
Exactly. So it's the same in every art form, though. I mean, in a movie director, a writer, an architect, whoever, you always don't do something. It's like something you would never, if you did it, you would rather have your hand cut off than design that, right?
Sure, yes.
Or write that. And when you see it in somebody else's building, you say, oh, that, I, you know, so we all develop our own,
repertoire of don'ts.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's at the center of what everybody does.
Yeah. Because then the place you hear it, the ghost occurs in other people's work. So you hear it someplace else.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
So do you think it should be explicit at some point? Do you think like a creative person should say, I'm not going to do this? Or you should just understand from the body of the work?
I think so,
certain things are excluded?
Yeah. It's like you said, you understand it from what you hear is there. Mm. It's because you have to develop a language that is consistent and is what it is. And I like my language. I don't know. Not everybody will like that, but you know. And some people will like mine and somebody else's, and that's how it is. And we're adults, and we can accept that.
Thank you.
questions.
So you were saying that there's not many venues for this type of music in Boston. So do you play more outside of Boston than you do at home?
There are two venues in Boston basically that have pianos and where you can play. And if you play very often, you're gonna have very small audiences. So you have to kind of space it out a little bit. That's not just for me; it's like for everybody. Yes, I do try to play outside of Boston as much as I can, but there have been times when it's been more outside than in Boston. But then sometimes I just want to have a band that we develop material with, so I'll just book, you know, like a regular gig, and I don't care if there's like three people in the audience, just to develop the material. Sometimes you have to do that, and then 1 week you'll have three, another week you'll have 10, but you just have to do it.
Anybody else? Anything else?
When I was listening to you, I was thinking of this book of Lévi-Strauss, you know,
called yeah?
Cook and Roll.
I don't know that book.
You know this book?
I've read Tristropic.
Yeah, right. And so it seems that somehow in your way of playing, there's very intellectual parts. Uh-huh. And sometimes you let yourself go to very raw. I mean, it's just like in this book, you know, there's something which is very elaborated, and on the other side there are things which are like extremely raw material, like where you just like put your elbow on the piano.
Yeah.
So how do you articulate those two aspects of things?
Yeah, I don't think they're separate, really. I mean, they're the same aspect. They belong to the same language. It's very organic to me when I don't see it as one being intellectual and the other one being raw. I think it's the same. It comes from the same place, and then I would hope that everything is raw. Basically, is what I'm saying. And everything is also intellectual.
It feels like there's, if you think about from a piano standpoint, the far end of that dichotomy is somebody like Dave Burrell. So pianist who plays very straight and then completely out and has almost no middle ground. And what's interesting to me about where you are is that there's a lot of middle ground. There's a lot of place where those two, let's say if there are two spirits, the yin and yang, are constantly intertwined. Mm-hmm. And there's this play, and that's, I really love that way that the thematic material was least often demarcated by a stop and a restart. It was instead kind of coming organically out of the improvised material.
At its best, this kind of playing is coming from is surprising to the improviser, you know. So you're improvising and you find an idea and then you're lost and you're guided by it. And so you have no conscious intellectual control over it because it's there. You have spent years developing, you know, your parameters. So when it comes, it just happens within that because you're trained in the. I mean, a big part is learning to play your instrument, learning your scales, learning that. But then another very, even more important is developing your style and, you know, the style. So you're in that style, and then it just happens. And when it's at its best, you just have to stay out of the way and let it happen. So maybe there were a few moments like that tonight, but it's rare that happens, and it's a great thing. I don't surf, but I think it must be what it feels like to be on a wave and surfing. Sometimes it just happens, and it's like, oh, now it's happening, and let me not get in the way of it, and it's the best feeling.
Is it something like abandonment?
Yeah, but it's based on I mean, there are different names for that. You hear musicians talk about that a lot. They call it transcendence or being in the zone or whatever. You hear musicians always talking about that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what you call it, but it's a great thing when that happens. I think all creative people have a moment like that where things just click together and you're not even aware how it happened.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a big can of worms, but I want to bring it up because I think it's an interesting question. I want to get your take on it. So you spent the first 20 years of your life plus in Greece.
Yeah.
Growing up in Greece. And I don't hear you playing Greek folk music.
Right.
Right. Like, I want to ask you a little bit about, that's sort of a cliche about an improviser who might come from somewhere sort of almost dutifully bound to play the music of their people.
Yeah.
And you don't do that. And I want to ask you, what growing up in Greece carries with you into playing now, and B, why don't you play the music of your people?
Well, one reason is because I didn't really listen to that music growing up. My parents were avid classic music listeners, and those were the records that I had at home, so that's what I listened to. It was Beethoven, Mozart, not even 20th century music. Mm-hmm. And also my parents, because we... I don't know... I don't know if this is good or not. I mean, I love Greek folk music, but I got to know it when I was 25 and older and already into jazz. And that's when I thought, oh, that's actually interesting. But earlier on, I had these cultural associations that that's village music or backwards or something. Mm-hmm. It's like my family didn't, because we didn't have any ties to, because my both sides of my my parents were both they came from Asia Minor in the 1920s, so we didn't have a village to go back to with, you know, like a village music. We didn't have village relatives. We didn't have any of that stuff. So they were like very bourgeois. It was a very bourgeois family, and maybe a little bit artificially so. I don't know, because that was the way to establish their social position. I don't know. You could be a little critical of that, maybe. But anyway, that was the environment. You know, there was the piano, there was the classical music, and also because there was a dictatorship for a large part of, you know, my childhood and young adulthood, and for one of the things that they promoted a lot was the folk music, you know. The Christianity, the folk music, and the nationalistic patterns, so they all blended together. So that those, you know, like clarinet players from the mountains, they were like the same thing as the priests and everything. So I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But later I discovered it was really cool music, and so that's why I... And then when I was 14, my brother gave me a cassette of Oscar Peterson, Night Train. And I just fell in love with that. I didn't know it was called jazz, but it was the coolest thing. So it just happened.